Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, my podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today, I mean, there are multiple ways I could introduce him, but I'm just going to let Dr. Charles Blanky introduce himself. Charles, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
I would. I am Charles Blanky. I'm a physician at the Knight Cancer Institute in Portland, Oregon. I will give you a little bit about my background. I'm born and raised in the Midwest, didn't manage to escape for about the 30 years of my life, if I include all of my oncologic training and first job. I spent my career kind of split between research and running large administrative cancer positions and cancer organizations. More recently, I have switched my clinical career to supporting patients at end of life.
I think that is an excellent introduction. As I said, you know, I could list you as a prominent academic, a medical aid in dying expert, and, you know, the until very recently, the leader of the Southwest Oncology Group, Cancer Cooperative Group. So all of that we will dig into. But let's start with young Charles. So brothers, sisters, mother, father, where were you brought up?
So most of my family is also from Chicago. I was born there and wound up, even though I have two older brothers, in a family in which I was sort of acting like an only child. I am the youngest cousin among my mother and her three sisters. So there were four whiner girls, if you will, that had a million cousins. And I was the youngest with an 11-year gap between me and my middle brother, Richard, who is the second youngest child. The two older brothers thus left home for college when I was still really tiny. And again, that sort of made me feel like an only child. My eldest brother is now in La Crosse, Wisconsin. He's a retired head and neck surgeon. And my middle brother is in Pennsylvania. He was an agronomist or a soil scientist for a number of years and then wound up doing a lot of computer networking for Seattle.
And what did your mom and dad do?
My mother was mostly stayed home. She actually had a number of health issues, which limited her working and doubtless shaped my early life. My father had a really interesting position. He was a chemical engineer by training, but he used his knowledge in this weird administrative post with Standard Oil, which became BP. He basically bought all of their crude. They would say, go to him and say, next year we anticipate we're going to need a lot of kerosene for whatever reason. And he would say, oh, then you have to buy the oil from Saudi Arabia because they could fractionate out kerosene very easily. So it was a pretty fascinating job, and also gave me the opportunity when we would go downtown in Chicago for various reasons to see plays and whatever, for me to visit the Standard Oil building, which is one of the tallest buildings in Chicago.
That's cool.
Enjoyed.
So you did have an older brother who went into medicine. So there was a precedent in the family.
Out of those gazillion cousins I told you about, the eldest, so I'm at the youngest end of the spectrum, my oldest cousin, Irwin, was actually a cardiac anesthesiologist and was the first doctor in multiple generations. Then no further cousin doctors until my brother and then me.
And then do you have a feeling as to when science or medicine started to appeal to you?
Yes, when I was 6 years old.
Now, that's very specific. Exactly six. What happened at six?
I didn't give you a date. I just remember I was a thoughtful child. And I remember thinking about all the possible careers. And I realized even then that medicine seemed to have a lot to offer. I read a lot of weird science books about epidemiology and the great plagues and the great early doctor inventors. And they really, really, really excited me. I knew even then that I wasn't going to just basically get a job in, I didn't know the term at the time, but basic science, because I liked interacting with people. So being a doctor seemed to be the best fit even then. And I dedicated the subsequent many, many years to achieving that goal.
Yeah. And you actually, you know, unlike some of them in the American medical system, you went straight into a track that was going to lead to medical school, if I remember correctly.
I did. I was in what we called a six-year program at Northwestern University. So basically, you're accepted into medical school when you're still in high school, which is obviously the way it doesn't usually happen. You then have a shortened collegiate track, which theoretically allows you to take a wider range of courses. And maybe if you were, you know, striving for all A's, so you could impress the medical school boards, admission boards. And then I went into medical school after the undergraduate years. So I think I was 17 at the time.
That's incredible, really. So coming out of medical school, I'm trying to figure out, what year would that be? What year would you have graduated medical school?
So I graduated medical school in 1988.
Okay, so in 1988, you come out, and then there's the usual surgery versus internal medicine. How did that decision affect you?
It's actually more complicated. Even though I told you that I knew I wanted to have some relationship with medicine from age six, I never outgrew my other secret desire to be an astronaut.
I love that. That's what I was fishing for.
I was waiting to see if you would laugh or not. And so I actually went to medical school on an Air Force scholarship with the additional goal of becoming a space doctor, if you will. So as part of that, I wanted to do a one-year training program following medical school, which was a prelude to doing an aerospace medicine residency. I also spent summers in the Air Force doing some aerospace medicine training. And so I went up to La Crosse, Wisconsin for that 1 year. Things got weirdly complicated because I became a type 1 diabetic, or at least was diagnosed with that disease that year. And it was quite clear that not only might I not be able to stay in the Air Force at all, I was certainly not going to be an astronaut. So I switched things over to internal medicine at that point.
And I'm trying to think what NASA was doing then. Was it like space shuttle time? Were you kind of dreaming about being a space shuttle doctor?
I think exactly what I wanted to do. And there was still some talk of a manned Mars program during my lifetime.
Wow. It's like, if only that would have been even greater.
And if this diagram, you can't see me gesturing like, you know, get smart show. Anyway.
Okay. So the astronaut future is denied you through a quirk of autoimmunity. And then what do you do? Then you come back and make a decision about specialization?
Well, luckily, the program I was in La Crosse, Wisconsin, had an incredibly strong internal medicine residency as well. And of course, I went to the program director and said, I can go elsewhere. But I think for now, internal medicine is the best path for me. And they were gracious enough to let me stay on in La Crosse for two more years.
Okay. And then you're doing general medical things at this point in time. Do you have a feeling for what specialization you're going to head towards?
Yes, and it shocked me. Unlike my decision for medicine, it was a complete surprise. Everybody was scared of oncology in my program. The patients were scary. The outcomes were scary. The doctors weren't scary at the program, but nobody really liked it. The hours were long. Yeah. But like many of us, I was hooked up with a senior physician who wound up being a nearly lifelong mentor, who was such an amazing clinician and patient advocate that he made me take another look at oncology. I loved the rotation. I then did a couple additional rotations in radiation oncology. And because he was well dialed in with the oncologic community, he wound up recommending I go to Indiana University, which was a major clinical oncology research powerhouse at the time, for my fellowship.
Do you want to give him a name check? Give him a shout out?
Sure. It was Dr. Robert or Bob Witt.
Okay. Why Indiana?
Indiana, just the fact that Bob recommended the people there and said it would really be a good match for my own style of medicine and personality. I already was interested in clinical research. I knew, again, I wasn't going to go back to pure basic science. And they were extraordinarily active. They had people like Larry Einhorn there, the father of testicular cancer chemotherapy, and Craig Nichols, and they were publishing 1 to 2 articles every single month in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And I knew from Bob and from my interview there that they had so many opportunities that they couldn't keep up with them. And they allowed their fellows to basically grab the ball and run with it and do as much as they felt comfortable. So I wound up having just a million opportunities to present and publish at a very junior level. And it totally shaped my career from the get-go.
Do you want to give us some examples of what you got out of that fellowship? But some of them were quite incredible.
Started out with just spending a summer in this incredibly hot building, reviewing 150 charts from a lung cancer study that Larry Einhorn had done but hadn't written up. But it wound up being an oral presentation at this giant lung meeting. And Larry was very generous. He said, you did the analysis, you can write the paper, you can do the presentation. that led to some other opportunities in lung cancer, but they also had things falling off their plate in germ cell malignancy. So I wound up presenting the results of a 5-drug cocktail in testicular cancer at ASCO, which was an incredible opportunity for a fellow.
One of the things you told me is that when you mentor people or you teach people early in their career, you tell them to say, what haven't you, you know, what do you have that's not finished, or words to that effect, which I thought was great advice.
I truly believe that you can be smart, you can have great instincts. You need to demonstrate that you will deliver on promises you make. And of course, you have to deliver in a relatively high class way. So I love to do roundtables for ASCO, and I do so every couple of years, and you're absolutely right. What I say to the young physicians is every organization has unfinished projects. Somebody was the PI and they moved, or they were the PI, but they never wrote up the manuscript. And basically just go to the leader of the program and say, what have you got that's just lying around and that you really want to get out there? Because we have an obligation as researchers to present everything, positive or negative. And I guarantee they're going to have a manuscript. They're going to have analysis of some data like I did in lung cancer. And if you do that analysis or write the paper, it will just lead to more opportunities. Once you get your name out there, other people will see your name. They'll see you at the presentations, and you may get lucky and get onto like an ASCO program committee or another committee from a cooperative group. It is the absolute best and most reliable way to build a career, at least in clinical research.
Were you involved in cooperative groups when you were in Indiana?
Yeah, they were members of ECOG. So I was a part of some of their ECOG research as well. And then I had unexpected opportunities during my first job at Vanderbilt, my first faculty job as well.
Yeah. So you complete your fellowship, and then Vanderbilt was where you get your first faculty job in medical oncology. Why Vanderbilt?
Well, partly because I loved Indiana. But Indiana said, we can keep you on, but the only opening is in breast oncology. And that wasn't the best fit for me at the time. I really, really, really wanted to do thoracic oncology. And that's, of course, what I had done a lot of my research in while I was at Indiana, as well as germ cell malignancy. Dave Johnson, who was the chair of medical oncology at Vanderbilt, again, had built this program that was doing extraordinarily exciting clinical translational research. I had a great interview there. I presented my paper on thoracic oncology, thinking I was going to get that position, and he offered me a job.
Wow.
Fortunately, I thought at the time the job he offered was only sort of in thoracic oncology. So Dave, the thoracic oncologist, Russ DeVore was there and was very active clinically and in research. And basically, Dave said, we really want you. Again, we think you're a great fit. You can publish to your heart's content, but you're going to be like number 5 in thoracic oncology, or you can lead the GI program. We need a GI person. And so I thought about it, and I thought, yeah, I think I'll grab the opportunity that's closer and take the GI spot. And then I spent my last 3 months of fellowship in Indiana jumping into the GI clinic, trying to learn everything I needed to learn in 3 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, you know, particularly early on, because although all of your time might have been spent in thoracic, it's still absolutely a relatively short time. And so you can re-differentiate.
Right. And the principles of how to do research stay the same. There was nothing different between thoracic and GI, with the exception of the diseases and the drugs. But clinical research principles were so strong in Indiana, and Dave was of a very like mind at Vanderbilt.
This gets to one of my favorite one of your anecdotes, is how you and Dave Johnson started to spar in the early hours of the morning.
I cannot say enough good things about Dave, and I'm not about to bash him, but he and I are both a little bit anal and a little bit competitive. So my very first day of work, I showed up at 5:30 a.m. and he came at 5:40 and was shocked to see somebody there. So the next day, when I came in at 5:30, Dave was already there. And I said, what the heck? He said, yeah, I came in at 5:20. I said, oh, you did. So the day after that, I came in at 5:10. Then we alternated coming in 10 minutes earlier than the other person until I came in at 4:40 and he gave up.
Oh my goodness, that is a wild. It's a kind of like a little cinematic scene that I can just sort of see play out.
It is friendly, albeit competitive.
Yes, I love that. But again, it's almost even though he was the chair of the department, he's a peer already, because you're just sort of sparring on the same level, which I love.
It's exactly right.
So talk me through your time at Vanderbilt.
Well, we had talked a little bit about, I don't know how nice it sounds, being opportunistic. I'm going to rephrase that as being in the right place at the right time and seizing opportunities.
Yeah.
So I was really, really lucky from day one. I walked in at 5:30, as we talked about, and there was a protocol on my desk. It was a pharma protocol in colorectal cancer. And Dave Johnson said, do you want to do it? You don't have anything else, you know, on your plate. You didn't obviously bring anything from IU in GI. It'll give you something to do. And I thought, of course I do. So it was, it involved a drug called trimetrexate, which was fairly novel.
Hold on, how do you spell that?
Trimetrexate, like methotrexate, except trime at the beginning.
Got it.
So it was a derivative that looked like it would be more exciting. So anyway, I'll be very frank. I loved clinical research already, and I hustled my rear end off and was putting 4 people a week onto that phase 2 study.
And it was colorectal cancer?
Yep, colorectal cancer. Lo and behold, like many phase 2 studies, we see an incredibly strong signal that this new combination might be very, very, very successful. So it's clear to me that the company is going to want to do a phase 3 trial. So I called the company up, said, hey, I'm your PI at Vanderbilt. I'm the one who's been accruing pretty well. By the way, I'm now the world's expert on clinical application of your drug. That's the exact phrase I use.
Yeah.
I said, I've treated more people with your drug than any human on this planet. I know everything about it. I know everything about the side effects, and I know everything about the research process involving your drug. What goes right, what goes wrong.
Yeah.
You should let me do the phase 3 that I know you're going to want to do.
I love the chutzpah of that.
That's a nice word for it.
Yeah. Which was it? What was the company? Can you remember?
Yeah, it was US Bioscience, which became Pharmacia, or actually might have become Upjohn and then Pharmacia.
Okay. So, how did they react to this young pup phoning up saying, I should run your phase 3?
It's hilarious. So they said, oh, what an interesting concept. We agree that you should be a part of it. And we are really happy. And by the way, I gave them the protocol that I'd already written just in case a phase 3 study, they wanted to do it. And they said, and I won't forget this either, but you're a nobody.
But they actually said that?
Yeah.
Or words to that effect.
I think it might have been those words, but anyway.
Where? Oh my goodness.
Now, okay, to be fair, maybe they said, you don't yet have a name in colorectal oncology.
Yeah, so that sounds nice, but it's the same message.
We will let you run the study, but we're going to stick you with somebody from Memorial Sloan Kettering who's famous. And they picked Nancy Kemeny, I believe, if I remember correctly, who was famous and was a brilliant colorectal oncologist, who, by the way, and I don't mean to insult Nancy because I have nothing but respect, I don't think she had treated a single person on the phase 2 or perhaps even ever used the drug because it wasn't used off-label. But they put her on with me as co-PIs.
Yeah, I mean, that is the nature of it. There is sometimes an element of window dressing with names, which I personally think is a little silly.
Well, I no hard feelings.
Yeah.
It was not a terrible thing to do. They let me run with the ball again, and we accrued again like gangbusters to the phase 3. And interestingly, they did a parallel phase 3 in Europe with a Cornelius Punt, and then they planned a combined analysis, which as many phase 2s that are positive turn into negative phase 3s do. This one was stone cold negative, and that was the end of the drug. And
yes, that's why none of us are using trimetrexate now.
But like we talked about before, I really got my name out of there. And I think that opened the door for me in ASCO and certainly enhanced my standing in the cooperative group. So when cooperative group opportunities came along later, I grabbed those as well. And people knew who I was.
So let's do your first segue into cooperative groups. Because I think, again, Dr. Johnson was instrumental in handing you an opportunity.
I'm laughing because I always said the crumbs that fell off Dave's plates were like boulders to the rest of us. I'll never forget, he came to me on a Friday afternoon. We were the only ones left in the office. And he said, hey, ECOG, wants to do a protocol with gemcitabine in small cell lung cancer. It's looking kind of promising. And my lung guy's a little bit busy. So I realize you are no longer a thoracic oncologist, but do you want to be the PI? Well, I would never turn any opportunity down, period, but the chance to be a PI, what the heck? And I said, of course I will. When do you need it by? He said, Monday morning. At the protocol itself. You needed the protocol by Monday morning.
Wow.
I locked myself in my office and I wrote the protocol start to finish. Dave edited it that Monday morning in about an hour because he was really good and really fast. And we got it back to ECOG and they immediately opened it and it accrued pretty well. And it was stone cold negative, but it was still an amazing opportunity. And again, I think it did help my name, if you will, within ECOG, even if it wasn't the GI committee.
And were you the PI of the study?
Yes.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
It was pretty cool. In here, we're a GI oncologist, but...
So a small segue here. So clearly, at this point in your life, you know, you are committing large numbers of hours to work, you know, burning the candle at both ends. What's going on in your personal life? Are you married? Do you have kids? You young, free, and single?
You know, it's so interesting that you ask that. And I do believe young physician, young investigators have the right to work-life balance. In my case, I was married, no kids. And my wife had a job as a journalist. My wife at the time had a job as a journalist and was very busy herself. So I really could. I could come in at 4:40, eventually a little bit later when Dave gave up, and stay till all hours. I worked every weekend. I think if I had been trying to be a father, for example, I couldn't have done it as successfully as quickly. Not to say that that's not the path many people choose and they're equally successful. But for me, in a way, it happened because I didn't happen to have children at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's true. And I've had many conversations with people on this show about what happens when the children come along and how you adapt or adjust. And, you know, it's never easy.
Now, later, after I had a daughter at a very young age, we just brought her along to meetings and she loved it. If I could tell you one funny story, if you would like to hear it.
Yeah, I love it.
So I was the education chair for ASCO. By this point, I'd had a bit of a name in ASCO. And again, I'll just tell you, this was very opportunistic. George Sledge, who was one of my mentors at Indiana University, was elected president of ASCO. And I had no idea how it worked, but I called George up and I said, George, I love ASCO. I've been on a million committees. I want to run the program committee, the committee that selects the abstracts for presentation while you're president.
Yeah.
And George said, well, you didn't know this because you don't know enough about ASCO, but the president and the program committee person have to be from the same institution. I said, oh. He said, but I'll offer you education chair. I'm like, okay, I'll take it. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is it turns out the president of ASCO gets 2 full floors at the Chicago Hilton to hold various entertainment parties, things like that.
Yeah.
But the program chair and the education chair split an entire floor themselves. So I walk in and I hardly can even call it a suite, has 17 rooms, 5 fireplaces, and I can't even tell you how many pieces of furniture.
What?
So I call my then wife up back in Portland and I said, we're never going to have a chance to stay in a place like this again. You know, we're fine. We're comfortable. We're never going to be uber rich and we're never going to have the shot. You need to come out immediately.
Yeah.
Come right now. Tell your job you're taking a week vacation and come on out. And so she comes out with I think Josie, my daughter, was 2 years old. And I can't describe the look on Josie's face when she sees this place as a toddler, but she immediately rips off all of her clothes and runs naked through each and every room in the hotel.
That is so fantastic.
You can decide if you want to use that story or not. But
I love it because that's the human side. There is, I mean, there's the bit.
I would have done the same if I could have gotten away with it.
well, we'll keep that as a secret.
Thank you.
I mean, I think one of the things about enjoyment in life is just to recognize when something amazing is happening and actually to smell the roses. And it's like, oh my goodness, they give me, you know, the whole floor of the hotel. That's amazing. And just enjoy it.
And I did.
All right, so you didn't stay at Vanderbilt, though.
No. My wife at the time was from the Pacific Northwest, And I had this weird relationship. There aren't very many programs out here. There was OHSU, there was the Hutch in Seattle, and that was it if you really wanted to be a true academician.
Yeah.
And so I would periodically interview at OHSU. I can't even count the times I interviewed. And they were a basic science heme powerhouse. But even though I had trained in hematology, I did not want to do it, nor did I think I was particularly competent in it. And I certainly had no research chops.
Yeah.
So I kept interviewing and saying, no, thank you, if I got a job offer.
So, hold on, let me just pick up. So they didn't go, it's Blanky again? He's never going to take an offer. Why are we interviewing him?
And I wanted to grow and, you know, I'll speculate my name was growing as a researcher.
Okay.
So I remember they actually said, yeah, you know, you can cover the hospital, and if you get somebody with acute leukemia at 3 a.m, you can call somebody.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want to be the attending calling a fellow for advice or anybody else for that matter. I want to actually be competent. Yeah. So no, thank you. But they periodically put up with it. But I was developing some friendships. It was kind of funny. I made some friends back in 94 that I still have to this day. Yeah. From OHSU. But anyway, one of my mentors at Indiana, Craig Nichols, became the chair in, I believe, 1997 or so, and he offered me his first faculty slot. And I knew Craig was going to change the program because he had been so successful in clinical and clinical translational research at IU. And of course, he was going to grow the solid tumor program. So he offered me a slot as head of GI. I can't remember if it happened right away or shortly after I came, but also the head of clinical research. So I took that opportunity and I ran out to Portland.
So how long were you at Vanderbilt before you shifted job?
4 years.
Okay.
Felt a little bad about that, but Dave, it was so funny. I remember telling Dave, and he was so professional about it. He said, I always knew as soon as you got a chance in the Northwest, you were going back. So he was very gracious.
Okay. So you then go to Oregon, and then this is, I think, again, you know, your highlights and my highlights may not completely overlap in terms of, you know, how I view your career, but something big really lands in your lap relatively soon.
Yes. This is the weirdest serendipity, I think, of all time. And as we talked about before, and I tell my fellows, you have to work hard. You don't have to be the most brilliant person out there, but please pay attention and try and observe and try and build on your observations. So I had a GI clinic, and one of the tumors I was treating, gastrointestinal stromal tumors, were awful.
Yeah.
He had essentially a 0% benefit from any chemotherapy, including chemotherapy effective in other sarcomas. And I was seeing a lot of them. They kept thinking, well, we'll go to the university and get better treatment. And sadly, they didn't get better treatment. They all still succumbed to their disease, and it was horrible. So Brian Drucker, who I truly believe is the father of personalized oncology, was doing his work with imatinib then and describing basically a 98% response rate and long-term benefit rate in chronic myelogenous leukemia with a drug known as imatinib mesylate, which your listeners may also know as Gleevec.
Okay.
And I remember, because of course I tried to see what my colleagues were doing, Brian published a paper, I think it was in Nature Medicine, that imatinib inhibited BCR-ABL, which is why it worked in CML, and it also inhibited PDGFR and KIT. But those enzymes weren't known to be important in human malignancy at the time.
Yeah.
Well, right after I get to Oregon, a Japanese group published a paper on gain of function mutations in human gastrointestinal stromal tumors in KIT. And they described that the overwhelming majority of GISTs expressed KIT, that it was mutated, the KIT gene, and that the mutant forms were always active. They were constitutively activated. Well, speaking of serendipity, shortly thereafter, Mike Heinrich, another giant in gistology, describes some work in which imatinib inhibits mutated KIT.
Yes.
So again, I don't think I was particularly a genius. I have a malignancy where nothing works. I know the driver of that malignancy, and we have a drug that very reliably turns that driver off. So I spent a fair bit of time composing a letter of intent to the makers of imatinib saying, please let me test imatinib in GIST. I have a really good feeling about this. I don't usually say things that positive, but I really do believe it's going to work. And to be fair to them, the CML market was kind of exploding at the time, and the GIST patients were very, very sickly, to be very frank. And they were a little bit concerned that toxicity of the drug might be confused with toxicities of the disease. And they said, sorry, we're not quite ready. So nothing happened. And I put the letter back in my filing cabinet. And probably about a year later, a fairly influential family in Europe has a family member with GIST. And they went to Dana-Farber and said, what would you do? Oh my gosh, this is such a terrible disease. And one of my eventual colleagues there, George Dimitri, said, holy cow, I'd get some imatinib. So they were successful in getting imatinib for this single patient with GIST. It melted away instantly. Wow. And that patient wound up being patient zero, who was described in the New England Journal of Medicine, who, as you know, doesn't normally do case reports. But this was such a phenomenal discovery. Untreatable disease, targeted therapy, worked really for the first time in a solid tumor ever. And so I remember I went back to the filing cabinet, pulled out my LOI, dusted it off, sent it back to the company. And they said, okay, we will let you do the trial. We went to run it with Dimitri, and we had co-investigators from Europe and Fox Chase. And lo and behold, instead of a 0% response rate, we had about an 84% response rate. And these responses were nothing short of miraculous. I've never seen anything like it. I doubt I ever will again. I had people who were near the end of life from their pounds and pounds of metastatic disease on high-dose narcotics. Of course, they were bedridden. They hopped out of bed within a week or two.
Wow.
Came off narcotics. Many of them went back to work. And years and now, decades later, some are still alive. So we wound up, of course, submitting it to ASCO. And I wasn't surprised it was selected for presentation. I was pleasantly surprised it was selected for plenary presentation. And that, of course, was definitely not harmful to my career.
So educate me here just a little bit. So chronic myeloid leukemia, like the vast majority is driven by this gene rearrangement BCR-ABL. And so you almost don't need to test for it. You just give the imatinib. In GIST, how common is the activated KIT?
Well, so in the original paper, 94% had KIT expression. And to be honest, we weren't actually smart enough at the time. And if I remember correctly, eligibility for our trial was KIT expression, not KIT gene mutation.
Yeah.
Later, we realized it was the mutation that was important, whether or not there was expression. And we got a lot smarter. We wound up looking at the various subtypes of mutations. We tried different doses, different drugs worked. I mean, this really was, it could have been and was a career builder all by itself because there was so much to test. We were able to test it in the adjuvant setting. But at the time, we got really lucky that we had what was effectively the wrong eligibility, but it wound up being right for the patients.
Well, and if you said it was 80% response rate, is that just luck that they all happened to have the mutation in your initial data set? I mean, did that response rate drop if the mutation is less common than 80%?
Well, I mean, that mutation holds across the board. So we had people from all over America and I believe Europe at the time, and it was very, very consistent. So, I mean, obviously we were lucky that, again, it inhibited this mutated KIT, which was present so commonly.
And so the plenary, you're probably what, an associate professor at this point, assistant? 2001, I think it was.
I was probably an associate at this point.
So things are going great for Dr. Blanke at this point.
They were fairly positive, yes.
So does that make you a gistologist? Were you still pursuing other avenues in your
Well, there's funny, I did a fair bit of research throughout it, certainly at Vanderbilt and at least initially at OHSU in esophageal cancer and pancreas cancer. Of course, we never had nimatinib.
Yeah.
But then I wound up doing more work in colorectal cancer. And again, I kind of grabbed a number of opportunities in the cooperative groups with leftover projects. And then I got myself onto the various committees involving GI malignancies. And then I became subcommittee chair for colorectal cancer. And then I had the opportunity to run the last cooperative group colorectal study in America with Alan Vinook from UCSF. But that was right around the time that both GIST took over, and that wound up being like 80%+ of my clinic, and medical aid in dying happened in Oregon.
Yeah. So that's the fascinating thing. So you you're developing a transformative treatment for cancer, and yet at the same time, you suddenly develop this expert, maybe not suddenly, but you develop this expertise in what seems almost like the polar opposite, the medical aid in dying, which of course Oregon is famous for. So can you talk us through a little bit about that timeline?
Sure. So medical aid in dying passed as a voter initiative in Oregon in 1994 by 1.31%. It squeaked in.
And that was the first state that did.
That was the very first state of what are now 14 U.S. venues that have legalized it. So it passes, immediately challenged at the federal level, where the Attorney General threatened to take away the license of any doctor prescribing medications under this act. Oregon fights back, makes its way to the Supreme Court. They rule 6-3 in Oregon's favor. It became a legal option in Oregon in 1997. The first prescription, which I did not write, was written in 1998, but I did write my first prescription the same year. I still had a fairly well-developed, in terms of numbers, pancreatic cancer clinic. And unfortunately, it remains a disease we're just not doing very well in, so I periodically had to write prescriptions. And then it became kind of like a snowball going down the hill. As I wrote more prescriptions, of course, I became more comfortable with it. I had to keep up with the potential changes to the law, the legalities of writing the prescriptions. And it turns out that most of my colleagues were believers in medical aid in dying, but they weren't comfortable writing the prescriptions. So they were happy to hand off their patients to me and then just have a peripheral role as a second opinion.
So let's just talk a tiny bit about the law, because it still involves two certifying doctors. Or actually, certifying may be the wrong word. It's like one has to sort of certify the prognosis and that they're not being coerced, and then one has to write the prescription.
Right. Well, they actually have overlapping duties.
Okay.
Both have to make sure that the patient is indeed terminal from their underlying disease, and they do have to ascertain the patient is acting of their own free will with a clear understanding of what will happen if they take the medication. But the so-called attending physician is the one who writes the prescription. And then the consulting physician just has a briefer role. And that's what most of my colleagues wound up doing. Then, as I wound up doing more and more of it, as reluctant as my oncology colleagues were to write the prescription, it turns out that my colleagues in other fields like neurology or pulmonary or medicine or cardiology were even less comfortable. So neurodegenerative disorders are the second most common reason patients get a prescription. I think I wound up inheriting probably all the patients from neurology who, for example, had amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
And certainly all the congestive heart failures, et cetera. We also have a very large Catholic system in town, and they're not allowed to write the prescription. So essentially anybody who had a terminal diagnosis seeking death with dignity at the Catholic hospital was sent to me. And then things really changed. Oregon is one of two states that does not have a residency requirement. So we can see people from any state in the union. And a lot of people live in states that don't have the law handy or legal, if you will. And so every single week I see people from Texas or the Carolinas or wherever. And that just built upon itself as well.
And they take the script back with them to wherever they've come from?
No, they do not. Because suicide, and this is not, by the way, considered suicide, but suicide itself is no longer a crime in any of the 50 U.S. states. However, aiding a suicide, however you define that, is a felony in many states. And so I remember this because a lot of my patients said the obvious. I don't live here. I don't have a house. I don't have any family or people to stay with. What do you want me to do? Go out to a hotel? Can I take the medicine back home where my support network is? And so I talked to legal and they said, you really shouldn't. Needless to say, the person taking the medication is not going to be prosecuted, although bad things could happen to them. They could wind up undergoing an autopsy, for example. But their family, if they're present or they in some way mix the medication, could be charged in a non-zealous state with aiding a suicide. And if they were in a really, really, really conservative state, we think it's possible they could be charged with murder or aiding whatever the actual crime is. So I got to the point where I actually have a checklist for my out-of-state patients, and I make sure I tell them, I'm sorry, it's really inconvenient. You can't bring the medicine back home. And if you tell me you're going to, I will not write the prescription.
It's funny because I think we talked about my own experiences with this, which also started off with being comfortable referring to someone else with the prescription, but then feeling part of my continuity of care meant that I didn't want to externalize that. And then I took on writing the prescription myself. But the idea of someone coming in who I have had no prior relationship with and then being the prescribing doctor, which is what you're reporting, how do you get your head around that? Because it's a, you know, you're meeting someone for the express purposes of ending their life. That's a very strange introductory conversation.
I actually took a lot of criticism over having a so-called boutique practice, which was simply end of life, and 95% of that was medical aid in dying. But I cannot tell you the number of patients coming to me, especially early on, who had had an oncologist for years. You know, they were diagnosed with localized disease, they got treated, they recurred, they got treated, the treatment failed. And eventually, they said to their doctor, is medical aid in dying a possibility? Because the doctors never bring it up themselves. The patient would ask, and this doctor, who they had a year's long or even decades long relationship with, would say, oh, I don't do that. I don't know anybody who does that. Good luck with it. No attempt to refer, no attempt to find me or anybody else for that matter. So I obviously felt terrible for the patient, and they would wind up at death's door by the time they got to my clinic. And I realized there's a gap there that absolutely had to be filled for the patient's benefit.
You can ignore this question if it doesn't sound right, but do you have a particular belief system that influences your choices in death?
Do you mean religious or other?
Well, you can take it any way you like.
Here's how I explain it, because I do a lot of debating and advocacy, whatever. People like to incorrectly trot out the Hippocratic Oath, and they love saying, first, do no harm.
Yeah.
And I absolutely agree, whether Hippocrates said that or said it as part of his oath or not. Our job as a physician is clearly not to harm the patient, it's to help the patient. But the real question is medical aid in dying offered to somebody who is suffering in ways we cannot relieve or has literally no quality of life harming them or helping them?
Yeah.
If you think it's harming them, you're not going to do it. I believe it's helping them. And that's how I justify it to myself and when I discuss it or advocate for it.
So talk us through what, you know, a visit with Dr. Blanky for medical aid in dying involves and ultimately results in.
It's interesting. I always start it out the same way. I tell them, we're going to review the medical situation. Well, first of all, I make sure that that's what they're there for.
Okay.
And you would actually be shocked at the number of people who come to end-of-life clinic who haven't been told that they're incurable. That's just a little pet peeve I have.
That's the jaw-dropping statement. It's like, why are they there? Or is it because someone else is bringing them there?
Their doctor made the referral and the name didn't register with the patient, and I'm not in any way throwing shade on the patient. I'm throwing shade on the doctor.
Yeah.
They referred him to my clinic without telling him their prognosis or even that they're going to die eventually from their cancer. That's a huge problem. We can spend an hour on that. But in any case, I gently explore that they understand why they're there. 90%+ of the time they do. Not always, however. Then I tell them we're going to go over the medical situation, because that determines their eligibility. A lot of people aren't actually eligible, and they are bitterly disappointed if they make it that far and they can't get a prescription.
But what are they usually ineligible on the basis of?
Sometimes, rarely, they don't have a disease that's terminal. That's fairly unusual.
Okay.
Commonly, they have a disease that's terrible, but isn't terminal, like Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
And so sometimes I can say, you're not eligible now, you will be later. Or you might have a complication of your disease that will qualify you. You have Parkinson's, which isn't inherently fatal, but you're unable to eat. So you're clearly going to die from protein calorie malnutrition. Totally legal, totally ethical, at least according to my ethicist. Anyway, we go over the timelines. If they're within that 6-month timeline, I then tell them I have unlimited time. And that's why I partly love this field. I can spend 2 hours with my patient if I want to, and I do. And we talk the nuts and bolts of what asking for a prescription looks like, getting a prescription looks like, and then ultimately taking a prescription looks like. Along the way, I mention multiple times, partly because I think it's important and partly because the state requires it, there is no pressure or expectation for them to take medication. I tell them, the state of Oregon and I could not care less whether you take the medication. We simply want you to do the right. And I'm glad you're smiling, which I will tell your audience, because luckily my patients usually laugh when I say that. But it is a bit of a relief because I don't want them to feel that they've done all this work or, you know, wasted my valuable physician time. I don't care. I don't care if I go out to their house to help them self-administer and they change their mind at the last minute. It doesn't matter to me. I just want them to have that right. And we make it perfectly clear. Then it's funny. It's either no questions or a million questions, but there's rarely anything in between. And then it kind of depends where they go from there. If they start the waiting period clock, because there's a built-in cooling off period in Oregon and the other states.
Then it's only like 2 weeks, I think.
It's 15 days.
Yeah.
Unless they are imminently dying, which is a whole other series of problems we can talk about if you wish. But basically, I tell them if they want it to be an option in their pocket as quickly as possible, I will see them again on day 15. And if we get all the paperwork, which includes that second opinion you and I talked about, a written request that they have to fill out that the state of Oregon makes as complicated as possible, and I rip up 80% of them and warn them that's going to happen, then I can write the prescription on day 15. Again, no pressure to fill it or take it, but it's available as early as day 15. Then we simply talk about, are you planning on taking it? No pressure to, but are you planning? If you are, do you want me there?
Yeah, when you told me that, that took my estimation of you to an even higher level. Mm. Because I got my head around writing the prescription, but I have never been physically there when the prescription is taken. And you took that really to the nth level.
It's funny the way that all happens. If you look at the Oregon data, and they collect a ton of information every year about every single prescription written, the vast minority of patients have their prescribing physician present. I think the last figure I saw was 16%.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes they have trained volunteers and others, but in general, their prescribing doctor isn't there. I have discovered, since I started asking, do you want me there? The answer is yes, 99.9% of the time. They are afraid something's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
They are afraid that something's going to happen and it'll work, but it'll be scary for their family. They're afraid they're going to wake up. And so when I started asking, do you want me there? Since the answer is yes, 100% of the time, but we're only there 16% of the time, I realized we're not asking patients if we should be there or not, if they want to have it, should be.
Yeah.
Because you want us. And it was an important lesson for me, but it definitely evolved over time.
And so that's the bit that, again, I have no experience of. But you, I mean, it's a very old-fashioned thing. It's a house call, really.
It is a house call.
Absolutely. And you going out, and then talk me through what that experience is like for you.
Every patient does it differently. The overwhelming majority have family and friends there. I think I've attended one death where the patient and I were the only ones there. And that was incredibly sad. I don't use that word very often in this business, because mostly it's a relief or comforting or relief of suffering, but that was sad. But what they do with those family members varies. As one I will never forget, 17 friends and family, 17 ukuleles, 17 people singing Kumbaya.
You can't make this up.
One patient, and I heard about this from one of our volunteers, had a party, 50 attendees. And then at the end of the party, they went upstairs and said, you can all come and say goodbye individually. You get time with me. But the price of admission in my bedroom is a joke. And I thought, what a fabulous way to leave this earth. 50 first jokes. Perfect.
I love that.
Yep. The one thing I'll tell you, it's really, really interesting. Even though I've said to the patients, you can change your mind, you don't have to take the medicine, you know, a third of patients don't actually wind up taking it. Once we get to that point, even though as soon as I walk in, I say, don't have to take it. I've never, out of the hundreds of times I've made house calls, had a patient not take it, ever. They are 100% sure it is the right thing for them. And they are, and I mean this, completely at peace with it.
Yeah.
The families are sad. They don't want to lose their loved one. They've usually seen how badly they're suffering and they're not fighting it, but they are, to be frank, much sadder than the patients at that point.
So what actually, and you, do you mix it? Does the patient mix
it? I do. It was it's changed a little bit. In the old days, the patient would take 100 secobarbital capsules, a barbiturate, But if you took 100 capsules, there's a lot of plastic and you wouldn't absorb it.
Yeah.
So we knew that we had to open up 100 capsules and root them all out with a toothpick into a glass of apple juice or water. Took me 40 minutes on a good day, and I don't have neuropathy from my taxane chemotherapy. And there was a question of, is that still self-administration required under the law if you do that?
Yeah.
Well, it became clear from the Oregon Health Authority that anybody, the family, I can help them prepare as long as they still take it on their own. But I definitely got in the habit of preparing it, if you will, back in the Cicobar days. Now we use a bottle of powder that you wind up adding some apple juice to. But I have also discovered, again, just through simply asking, do you want me to prepare it for you? And the answer, again, is yes, 100% of the time. And it's not obviously a functional question. I don't know if there's some kind of onus for the family member that they do think that they're sort of hastening the death, or there's some other reason it bothers them, or maybe they just want more time with their family. But they do always ask me to prepare it.
One of the things, again, it's the nitty-gritty practicalities of one of the things you told me is how quickly you're going to become unconscious, and therefore physically where you are when you take the prescription is important.
Both of those elements are important. I always say to the patient, and I remind them at their house, you need to consume this medication on the bed or the couch where you wish to leave this earth. Most people are asleep in 4 minutes. I also tell them, by the way, please say anything on your mind, say goodbye to your loved ones, pet your dog. Whatever you want to do, do it right away. Because, you know, the average is about 4 minutes, but sometimes it's faster. I also tell them, I don't want you to drink the medicine and then get up to walk to bed and fall and break your hip and leave your family with a very difficult decision, or have your last moments of consciousness be while you're in agony from a broken hip.
Yeah. And then, do you stay in the room? I mean, are you in the room when they drink the medication?
Yes, I'm always in the room when they drink it, just in case they get nauseated and I need to give them some IM Haldol or something else. I rarely have to coax them to take all the medication. It's very bitter and it burns a little bit. And if you think about it, you don't want them to take a couple of sips and then say, I'm done, and get a less than lethal dose. It's bitterly disappointing for everybody. So every once in a while, if it's really, really bitter, I just remind them of the importance of consuming all of it. But most importantly, I just want to be with them and explain to them, yes, it's normal for you to feel dizzy or very, very lightheaded. It's okay. You're actually on schedule. It's great if your goal is to, you know, be relieved of your suffering. Then when they're asleep, I tell the family about what side effects are common. Everybody turns funny colors, sometimes fun, or even bright purple from the hypotension. And I tell them it's not a bad sign. It's a good sign. The breathing patterns can vary from incredibly rare breathing, and I mean once a minute, which is unbelievably biologically hard to explain, to gasping and sounding like they're choking, which they're not. There's no air hunger or awareness of needing air at all. So I explain to the family a lot of things that sound scary might happen, but they're not unpleasant for your loved one. Then I tell the family, I want to give you privacy. I'm going to go to your living room, go to your basement, whatever, and I'll come back regularly every 15 minutes, or if you need me, and you might need me because something's happening that you don't understand and want explained, or you're worried your loved one's suffering, or you think they passed away.
And then, are you the one who certifies them dead at the end?
99% of the time, if they wind up being in the microscopic fraction that take 19, 20, more than 24 hours, I go home at night. Sometimes they go back to my clinic in the afternoon, and occasionally they'll call hospice. And very, very rarely, and this is more a problem with people from out of town who aren't on hospice and say, I'm traveling myself. Oregon's a weird state that does not require a trained physician or nurse to pronounce a person dead in order for the funeral home to take him away. So theoretically, the family can notice they're not breathing and call the funeral home. Whether the funeral home's accepted or not is another matter.
We said it was 4 minutes to unconsciousness. What's the average time to actually passing on?
So it's still about 40 minutes average, but or median, but the range varies widely. What I tell people is 80% are gone within 2 hours. But I always tell them the extremes. There's roughly 0.5% chance that you will be asleep for more than 20 hours. If you are, it is not bad for you. You are blissfully unaware of it. but I cannot describe the stress level in a family once they're asleep for more than 4 hours. So I mentioned it a number of times, and I'm not blaming anybody. It's still a shock when it happens every single time.
Is it usually you or the family who's aware that the death has actually occurred? I mean, do you have to tell the family that they've gone?
That's a great question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. Because the breathing is so irregular, I think it's very hard for families to know. Every once in a while, they'll say, oh, grandpa gave out a last gasp, and we think that's the last time he breathed. But more commonly, I'll do it myself.
And then this is, again, you know, not to get too, you know, metaphysical here, but are you aware of a change in feeling when somebody dies if you're in the room?
I think I am. I've seen this 500 times now, and I don't know what level to explain it on, but there's a palpable difference for me if they're comatose versus dead.
Wow. And then you have the, you know, the practical job. You phone the funeral home. Is that what happens next?
Yes. I call the hospice if they're not present, and ask the family in advance, do you want hospice to come out to support you? They're obviously not coming for the patient in this case, and they almost never do, interestingly enough. And then the family has so much emotional stuff on their plate. I try and do anything practical that I can. So I do wind up calling the funeral home, and the family is always surprised. I always tell them again, the funeral at home is going to ask you how long you want with your loved one before they come. It could be anywhere from come right away to come 24 hours from now. And every once in a while, and this still surprises me, they want 24 hours with their loved one before the funeral home comes. Not commonly, but it happens.
So again, there's this amazing dichotomy in you where, you know, developing therapies for cancer and then developing therapies at the end of life. And I say therapies deliberately there because it is in a sense.
Thank you.
But talk me about how you eventually later stepped up to a role of actually leading one of these, you know, treatment-focused cancer cooperative groups.
Treatment and end-of-life focused. So I'll come back to that in a couple of seconds because you're absolutely right. You look at the main emphasis in the raison d'etre, of course, is to try and prolong life.
Okay.
And all the subsequent things, of course, relieve suffering, extend life. And of course, we have a very active palliative care committee, but that came late on my watch. I was in Vancouver, BC at the time, and I had actually gone up there to run chemotherapy for the province. It's obviously a very different system than the American system of oncology. And I was loving it. I was doing GIST up there. And I was a pretty active member of the what formerly was known as the Southwest Oncology Group. I think I was chair of the GI committee. I secretly still wanted to be the chair of the group, but I thought it would be fairly late in my career. While I was in Vancouver, the acting chair stepped down very early in his tenure, shocking everybody.
Yeah.
And I thought, holy cow, the guy before him was chair, I think, for 35 years, somewhere between 25 and 35 years.
Yeah, they're like Supreme Court justices. It's almost like a lifetime appointment. And
it was a lifetime appointment. That's absolutely correct. And if somebody else gets in there now and wants it for 25 years, that's the end of my career. Maybe I'll throw my hat in the ring as complete dark horse.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty young and I don't have a great reputation. I'm certainly known, but I don't think I'm super famous or internationally famous or whatever, except maybe in this little tiny niche world of GIST. But I like to say that I ran on an Obama campaign of real change. And for whatever reason, it resonated with the voters who were the board of governors of SWOG. And to everyone's surprise, notwithstanding my own, I was elected.
What year was that?
So I was elected in 2012.
Okay.
And I remember so clearly going to the NCI, National Cancer Institute, and saying, hey, I'm SWOG chair now. It'll be a good chunk of my job. But of course, the grant has to go to my home academic institution. Vancouver is an institution in SWOG. Do you have any trouble with the grant going there? And I really thought they'd say, no, go right ahead.
Yeah.
And they thought about it for 2 weeks and said, nope, got to be American.
Oh, wow.
So I had to move as a result of the SWOG election. And I wound up going back to OHSU at the time.
And let's just give a little background. So the cancer cooperative groups were started 1950s, something like that, with government funding to do clinical trials.
Yeah, they actually preceded the NIH itself,
yeah.
But they were set up to be a cooperative group system. And they all morphed, although the original groups are still there in one form or the other, even to this day. And you're right. They are, of course, very heavy on the treatment side. And they have a lot of what I'll still call anatomically based committees, GI, lung, GU. Yeah. Sometimes they semi-specialize, if you will, in things like rare cancers. They're increasingly looking to pathways. And then they also developed expertise in what I like to call population science, like prevention and epidemiology, symptom control, quality of life. And in SWOG, and whether it was because of my own personal interests or just because we thought it was important, decided to implement a palliative care committee. And that's been pretty successful as well.
And I think one of the things, so that your predecessor was Larry Baker, and I remember hearing him reveal how much money the SWOG got from the government, which I was stunned at how low it was, not how much it was. So he, and again, you're the expert here. So I remember Larry Baker saying the entire budget for SWOG was like $20 million a year. Does that sound about right?
It's varied year to year, but you know, it's funny. I'll tell you a little anecdote related to that, if that's okay.
Sure.
So suddenly I've got to get back to the States. I need a job.
Yeah.
And I go back to OHSU and I tell them things have to be a little bit different this time around. The other reason I think I was successful in my campaign, if you will, is I told the voters, I don't think a cooperative group chair can do this off the side of their desk.
Yeah.
I want to be a full-time chair minus my clinic.
Yeah.
Because that's how involved this is and complicated nowadays. So I went to OHSU and I said, it's got to be a little bit different. I'm not going to take call. I'm going to be doing a ton of traveling. I'm not going to take 2 weeks of service, which I think is incredibly important, but service is a 19-hour a day job. I can't leave SWOG alone for 2 weeks at a time. So you have to accept me with these conditions. The plus side is you'll get a 26% indirect rate on multiple millions of dollars, minus my salary, which I anticipate is not going to be multiple millions of dollars. And they said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. And so I got the job and that was great. But I'll also flip that to tell you that we do more with those paltry millions than you could ever imagine. SWOG actually did an analysis a few years ago to see the cost and cost effectiveness of our research. And to cut to the chase, we actually determined on top of the millions of life years that the cooperative groups had saved, that it came at a cost to the federal government of $326 per life year. Now, if you look at renal medicine, $70,000 per quali, if you will, is felt to be a pretty good bargain. So $300 is really something. And we are a wonderful investment, in my opinion, which is a little bit biased.
No, but it's an impressive number. So I want to finish my Larry Baker story. Okay, so $20 million for the whole of the cooperative group, all tumor types. And, you know, one of the phase three studies that I run, I remember, was $70 million. One study. One pharma-sponsored study. So there is an element of, you know, doing more with less. I get that. But the reality is, when we talked before, you know, what are the tenets of a cooperative group? It's to do the studies that pharma won't do.
Exactly right.
Which could be de-escalation studies. It could be this standard of care versus that standard of care. If people didn't want to go head-to-head. It could be rare tumor types. Pediatrics, you mentioned as well.
Modalities.
Yeah. All of that I love, but the question is, does pharma still have an influence given you only have a budget of $20 million?
Well, to build on my previous answer and your follow-on question, one of the reasons we can do it is because of volunteer labor. I mean, yes, people get a little bit of money to run a study, but in reality, the people who are our committee chairs or principal investigators are donating so much of their time. And we are talking about rural leaders in the field who really are truly altruistic. That said, the sites are altruistic too, because one of the reasons that pharma studies are expensive is because research is expensive and clinical research staff is expensive. So when Vanderbilt does a study, a cooperative group study, they're going to actually lose money. They have to believe in the science And like you said, the importance of doing a trial to see if less chemotherapy will be as effective as more chemotherapy, which of course is a true patient benefit. But I also have to call out in a positive way, the drug companies. They're giving us the drugs for this purpose. They are perhaps paying distribution costs. And sometimes they give us extra money for associated translational studies or other things that the federal government can't pay for. So the federal budget is not the entire budget, even though it's the majority of the budget.
If the pitch is we can do the studies that pharma doesn't want to do, pharma can still say, no, we still don't want you to do it because we're not going to give you the drug, or we're not going to give you ancillary funding.
Is your question, does that happen or how do we deal with it or something else?
Well, I'm just calling that out as a potential elephant in the room. So it's not entirely, it's not that it's not an independent organization,
no,
but it cannot function independently because of financial constraints.
That is absolutely correct. Yes.
So how do you, so if you were running the universe, given that you've stepped down, what, a week ago, then if you were running the universe, would you change anything?
I would, but I'm not sure that I could, per se. For example, if we had wide access to a company's pipeline, and they had, of course, perhaps some scientific input into the use of the drug, but didn't have a lot of contracting issues or even use of the drug, as you brought up yourself, of course, it'd be better for the cooperative groups, but pharma would argue it wouldn't be better for them. That said, I think, of course, unrestricted use of the drugs would be fabulous, with just peer review being the only limit.
Yeah, I remember one of the past leaders of the lung group in SWOG, David Gandera, and I called him the master of the art of the possible, because, you know, you can have all of the grand ideas, but at the end of the day, you have to find that Venn diagram overlap between what you want to do and what's possible, and that's where you actually have to go, and it's still valuable.
And I'll say you have to be, we started out our conversation, a little bit of a salesman.
Yeah.
You may have to convince pharma that this is in not only the patient's best interest, but their best interest, because they have an obligation to their stakeholders.
So you were chair for not quite Supreme Court justice length, you know, 13 years?
13, right.
And what are you most proud of during that time?
I love that question. When I was at Vanderbilt, we were helping our Associated Veterans Hospital and its veterans so much. And by helping, I mean offering them clinical trials. And circling back again, I've always believed the best oncologic treatment is a clinical trial. So we were putting on patients every single week and offering them, the veterans, the hottest new drugs. Veterans Administration research dried up later in my career for a number of bureaucratic and financial and, believe it or not, privacy-based reasons. I piloted a program in SWOG where we basically tried to relieve a number of these burdens to see if we could increase access, and we did. And subsequently, the NCI realized that we could get our veterans back on the trials, and this became a nationwide effort. That's probably number one. Number two, we built the biggest patient advocacy corps in SWOG, and we have people who are now involved at every stage of the protocol's lifespan, not just at the very end. Would you go on this trial? You would? Great. Okay, well, we've talked to our patient advocate. They're involved with the design, obtaining the drug, monitoring for side effects, and even the dissemination of the results. And I think that has improved the quality of our programs 1,000,000%. And then finally, I've always been a believer that eligibility criteria for oncology trials were too strict. And they limited the applicability of results to just that population of, you know, Olympic athletes who were strong enough to go on to a trial. And so I was actually part of an ASCO effort to make it a little bit easier and ease some of the burden. But we realized it wasn't just eligibility. There were a number of reasons that protocols were hard to do. We talked before about this cooperative group system being around since the 50s. The earliest protocol, I think, was 8 pages long, including the consent. Now, you know, the average consent itself is 40 pages. Right. And there's no way the patient gets through that. The site requirements for collecting data, first of all, can you document every aspirin the patient took between 1990 and 1995? So the pre predecessor history is ridiculous. And then they have to monitor for every potential side effect, whether or not it's related to the drug or their participation is ridiculous. So we basically started the pragmatic trial in SWOG. Very broad eligibility criteria, so the results are applicable. Maybe the control arm is whatever the treating physician thinks it should be, the standard of care. Collection of data, super easy for sites. And the first trial, Pragmatica Lung, accrued like gangbusters. Again, you didn't have to be a genius to predict this would be successful, but it was. Make it a trial, positive operational design. And I truly believe that 40% of cooperative group research will be pragmatic going forward as a result of SWOG. And I think the pharma is starting to adopt this as well. I'm really proud of that.
And when you step down, is that because you paid attention to your own term limits or?
Foolishly or not, the first thing I did as new chair was say, you can't be chair for 35 years. You're not fresh. You can be really competent and brilliant, but you're not fresh. So the very first change I made to our constitution was term limits.
Excellent. Charles, this has been an amazing journey just talking this through with you. I mean, given that you're now freed up your time, having stepped back from SWOG, what are you looking forward to in the next few years as we wrap up?
I'd like to do more advocacy in medical aid and dying and just patient rights in general. I think there's a huge need. Of course, I still want to contribute here at Knight and see more efficacious medicines developed. But I just think that there are still other operational things we can do to make the patient's life easier and better. And I'd like to see more effort put into that realm.
Charles, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with hosts me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.